supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we hear a lot in the workplace that it's changing in large part because of the millennials entering the workforce. They're the first to grow up in the brave new world of computers and the internet. But what does it mean to be in different generations today? After all, I Skype regularly with my grandson. And when my 7-year-old buddy Jacob and I play, very often we play Angry Birds Star Wars, which I have yet to win. Nevertheless, they were born in the digital age, so probably they see the world a bit differently than I do. So how does this translate to the workplace? And when Jacob enters the workforce in another decade or so, he may very well be working in a career that hasn't even been created yet. Joining me today to talk about these issues is Tom Koulopoulos. He's the author of The Gen Z Effect. Later, we'll talk with Gerald Davis about his book, Changing Your Company from the Inside Out, A Guide to Social Intrapreneurs. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Are you in the workforce? Are you dealing with different generations? Are you having trouble with communication? Do you see the world differently? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, Tom Koulopoulos, thanks so much for joining us.
Dan, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, listen, so the story is about interacting with different generations in the workplace, but you blew this whole idea out of the water right from the beginning. So why did you do that to such nice people like us?
Well, I wasn't trying to disrupt any more than we need to be disrupted. Let's put it that way. I think we are entering a post-generational world. And the reality is, if we try to run our organizations, ourselves, our businesses, our government, any of our social institutions with 5, 6, 7 generations, and if we look at it that way, what we create are generational divides. We put wedges between people. And that never serves to help us collaborate, to help us work together. So let's look at it differently. Let's drop the generational baggage and think about how we can work across those divides. To me, that's a much more optimistic, productive way to look at the workforce. So call it a post-generational world where generational labels just don't serve us well.
Let me stop you there. The language post-generation. I mean, I get post 9/11 or even post Enlightenment, but we do have generations that are born at different times with different experiences and different relationships with the world around them.
We have, and you said it in your opening comments, Dan. I was so glad to hear you talk about your relationship with Jacob and with your grandchild. Those experiences that were once so separate, so distinct from one generation to another, are now melding. They're creating shared experiences. And you using Skype on a tablet or an iPhone with your grandchild is creating that shared experience. So we're removing what used to be very hard generational boundaries. It doesn't mean the cohorts go away. We'll always share experiences with those we went to high school with or to college with. But increasingly, if you look at how kids game, you talked about Angry Birds, right? They don't game based on generation. They game based on competency. If I'm 80 and I'll game with a 7-year-old or a 12-year-old, if they can play the game, then we're on the same team. And that's what I mean by post-generational. We don't eliminate cohorts, but we start to focus more on behaviors, on capabilities, and on those things that truly add value to a relationship, to an organization, to a society. That, to me, is a much more positive way to look at the notion of generations and the way that we have been. And by the way, just a quick anecdote, right? Boomers love to bash millennials. Mm-hmm. The reality is they have more in common than they'd ever want to admit, because boomers say millennials are entitled, they're lazy, they're idealists. Well, these are the same folks that were wearing tie-dyed blue jeans and talking about free love and trying to change the world. The similarities are striking. And when we when we call someone by a generational label, we remove the opportunity to find those similarities.
You know, when you talked about lazy, you know, I'm a boomer, and at first I got defensive, but you're right. At first I got defensive. So listen, early in your book, you cited some major global issues that threaten the life of the planet: climate change, income disparity, global poverty, energy, so on and so forth. So tell us about this Generation Z that you're focusing on. After all, this cohort was born, what, between 1990 and 2010?
Yeah. So the boundaries are a little fuzzy because there's no official body that tells us when these generations begin and end. When we look back retrospectively, we pick a line in the sand and we draw it. The official line in the sand, if you look at how most people are characterizing it, is 1995. So if you were born into Gen Z, you were born into 1995 to the present day. And those are the kids that are just beginning to enter the workforce, or just coming of age. But look, if you think of Gen Z just as a birthright, I think part of what we're missing is that it's also a set of behaviors. So these kids born after 1995 have been teaching their parents and their grandparents how to use tablets, how to use the internet, how to communicate and collaborate. And it's one of the first times in history that kids have been the mentors to the adults. It's a fascinating anomaly in that regard. So if you're born into it, it's after 95, but you can adopt those behaviors, and you can be just a Z if, in fact, you choose to behave as Z does. And that's important. I think that's it's a healthy way to look at the way that we sort of pick and choose the way we decide what generation we belong to and what sort of behaviors we're going to adopt.
Yeah, it's really interesting that I love the experience of having Jacob or my grandson Sam teach me, and how much I enjoy having them as teachers, and how much I can look at the looks on their faces.
Yes.
How much they enjoy teaching me.
Well, now imagine taking that, Dan, and I've done this with so many companies, and it's striking the degree to which they just don't get it. Imagine taking that same basic framework and applying it to an organization, saying, when these kids come on board, why not make reverse mentors out of them? Why not allow them to mentor folks who don't quite get social media, don't get Facebook or Twitter or Instagram? And some companies are doing that. GE has been doing that since 1999, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And yet, in our experience, less than 14% of all companies have a reverse mentoring program in place. And it's so easy to do and so enormously gratifying and positive for the culture and for the people in the organization, but so few companies do it.
Tom, tell me what that looks like, reverse mentoring.
So at GE, when Jack Welch did this back in 1998, 1999, his objective was to get every one of his senior execs paired with someone just coming out of school that was hired by GE so that they could better understand the importance of the Internet. Because back then, if you recall, we weren't quite sure what the Internet was going to do for us and how impactful it would be. And Welch felt it was critical that his senior executives understand it from the point of view through the lens of a 20-year-old, someone in their early 20s who was immersed in it and living and breathing it. The way it works in most companies, Cisco does this, is they'll bring on board a new hire, and they'll match them very methodically with an older, more senior individual, and they will meet on a regular basis. It could be weekly, it could be every other week for a few hours, whenever the older protege needs some help understanding the intricacies of Facebook or some other social media platform or some technology, they will rely on their mentor, the younger mentor, to help them out with that. So it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship because they're both feeding off of each other's experience at the end of the day.
Wonderful.
But it also bridges that divide. It says, look, we're not going to be generational. We're going to cross that divide. We're going to allow those behaviors to move through a permeable culture from what was one generation to the other. Very simple, very straightforward, yet so infrequently done.
You know, you mentioned in early on in your comment just now about Jack Welch and implementing this. You said around 1998. You said that we had this internet and we didn't quite know what it was. My God, that was only 15 years ago.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, my God.
Isn't it amazing? Well, you know, I one of the things I would suggest any of the listeners do in their spare time, go on the internet and do a quick Google search for AT&T's You Will ad campaign, which was, I'm not going to tell you when it was run. It was, it's amazing how not so long ago it was. In that series of ads, AT&T predicted the future with magnificent precision. What you will see is exactly what we are living today. You will see Netflix. You will see Amazon. You will see ebooks, GPS. Everything we have today, you will see in those ads. They understood the future precisely, and yet, it was 1993. We thought this was going to be hundreds of years off in the future. AT&T got it, but AT&T did not bring a single one of those products to market. And it shows you how we can understand and appreciate the future, see it clearly, and yet not understand how much it's going to change us. And I think this is a big part of what's happening to us right now. Generationally, we're all being thrust into these new technologies. And to survive, to exist in this society, you have to understand the behaviors associated with these technologies. And so much of this change, so much of the future is built around behavior. It's not just the technology, right? It's the behavior. And behavior is most often thought of as generational, and that's why we wrote the book. We wanted to write The Gen Z Effect to get people to understand it's about picking behaviors. It's not just about technology. You pick the generation you want to belong to based on the behaviors that you adopt.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about, well, the Gen Z effect. This is this youngest cohort that are just starting to enter the workforce now and how they're changing things. They're flipping things around upside down. And my guest at the moment is Tom Koulopoulos. He wrote the Gen Z effect with Dan Keldzin. He's also the founder of the Delphi Group that we'll follow up and talk about later. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Are you or are you related to a millennial or a Gen Z? And what's it like in the workforce for them? Or what's it like for you if you're older in the workforce? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. So, Tom, I want to pick up on something here. You said technology flattens the generational divide. Okay. But you go on in your book and say, quote, technology pulls us faster and faster. Well, certainly, you know, this is exciting, but isn't this part of the problem that it's technology that's pulling us? Who's in charge?
Yeah. Well, look, I would absolutely make the point that it's difficult today to tease out the degree to which we're driving the behavioral change versus technology sort of pulling us into these new behaviors without us questioning whether they're good behaviors or bad behaviors. So here's a question I often ask people, and I'll tell you the answer in just a minute that I most often get. It's pretty startling. I ask people if they sleep with their smartphones in the same bed, not just on their nightstand, but in the same bed. And about 20% of the people who answer that question do sleep with their smartphones in the same bed. 50% sleep with a smartphone within arm's reach, and it's on 24/7 for those people. Now, is that a good behavior? Is it an aberrant behavior? Is it a healthy behavior? We can't answer those questions yet. We haven't done it long enough to know, but we certainly know that it's a different behavior. And part of, I think, what we need to do is look at the technology not just as a device, not just as a gadget, but look at it as something which has an impact on us behaviorally, and then answer the question not is the technology good or bad, but is the behavior appropriate? Is the behavior healthy? And that's a much more important question for me to answer at the end of the day. And I think we're in the throes of it right now, Dan. We're very much trying to figure out what these healthy behaviors are. The best we can do as parents, because I'm a parent of two Gen Zers, is to provide a bit of a counterbalance. And I will be completely transparent with you. I did not allow either one of them to play with computers or with the handheld devices until they were, you know, well into their 7, 8 years old, well into their school years, because I wanted them to first learn how to socialize and to read and do all those wonderful things. So I hold on to the past as much as anyone else does, but at the end of the day, we are surrounded by this platform of technology, and we have to somehow integrate it in a healthy way into our behaviors.
I'm a therapist, and I got to tell you, excuse me, what I see in my office, what I see in my lectures, is that people are racing, like you said, faster and faster, and they don't have time to reflect and ask the bigger questions. You know, what's my life about? What's important to me? What are, you know? And they certainly don't give their kids time to ask the big questions either. And I see a great deal of suffering in the wake of that.
So here's I'm so glad you brought that up, because here's an interesting perspective on what you just said. This search for meaning and for purpose is universal. It is the human experience. I think we all want to be part of something larger than ourselves at the end of the day. In many ways, this is a central ethos for Gen Z. They are so driven by the importance of purpose and meaning. And I'll give you one example that we talk about in the book. We talk about a number of Gen Zers who have done some incredible things. One of them, Easton LaChapelle, used to play with Legos when he was a kid. As he got older, he started working with 3D printers, and he started printing prosthetic arms and prosthetic limbs. And what he created was a magnificent prosthetic that rivaled anything on the marketplace. In fact, it could more fully articulate the fingers and the wrist than could any prosthetic available commercially. Easton sold that prosthetic for about $800 a piece, whereas it would cost about $80,000 to get it through normal channels commercially. Wow. However, and here's the kicker, here's where the meaning and the purpose comes into play. Easton said, I am going to open source this, and anyone can use my technology. I'm not going to protect it under a patent. I'm not going to secure it somehow because the IP is valuable to me. And his response to us when we asked him, why did you do that, was, how could I not do that? How could I not share this with the world? How could I not allow people who would never have a chance at a prosthetic to now have the ability to use my device? And by the way, said Easton, I don't see that as taking away from my success, from my ability to build a business with this. That's a very different perspective, isn't it, in terms of the importance of integrating meaning into the business, not just doing it as an aside, as an afterthought, but actually integrating it into the business. That's a wonderful way, I think, to look at the world. And it gives me encouragement. It says to me, Gen Z is not just about ideals. They're about action. They're putting these things into place. And when they're the legislators, when they're the ones who are the CEOs, it will be incredible to live in that world. I just hope I'm there to participate in it, because it will be an amazing world.
All right, so two questions about this young man and and his cohort. First of all, what was his age?
When he began doing this, he was actually in middle school. When he finally decided to commercialize and to open source the IP, he was in his early 20s, I believe.
My God. But the other question, and to me the more important one, is, are you comfortable generalizing about this young man?
So that I get that question about a lot of the Gen Zers that I put out there as role models. And in every cohort, in every community, in every gathering of humanity in whatever form, shape, or substance, there will be those exceptional individuals. And clearly Easton is one of those exceptional individuals. There are others that we profile. However, I think we are going to see more and more of the exceptional become the norm, if that makes any sense, because there are 4.5 billion people on the face of the planet who don't have access to a good education. A billion of them don't have access to clean water or to sanitation or to health care. When we finally connect everyone across the globe, when everyone has the ability to get a college education, when everyone has the ability to contribute somehow to the world and to solving these massive problems, from climate change to great pandemics, what will that world look like? How many more exceptional people will exist? And I think that, to me, is the exciting part of this, is that we are educating the world. We're making the world a classroom, and we're giving everyone the ability to strive towards that ideal of that Easton is setting. They may not get there, but they're certainly closer to it than they are today. And this notion of universal connectivity is as important as was education in the 19th and 20th centuries to reshaping the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Tom, we've got to take a short break. When we get back from our 60-second break, we're also going to be joined by Jerry Davis, who's written Changing Your Company from the Inside Out, A Guide for Social Intrapreneurs. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. And remember, our number, 888-477-9499. We'll be back after 60 seconds. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the ever-changing or rapidly changing workforce. We've been talking with Tom Kalopoulos. He wrote The Gen Z Effect. And now we're also joined by Jerry Davis. He's a professor of management at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Jerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Dan. Thanks very much for inviting me on. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing, Jerry?
Great, thanks.
Oh, you guys know each other.
It's a smaller world.
Well, we do now.
Smaller by the day.
So, Jerry, you're in your book, you talked about a Kevin Thompson who works at IBM. Tell us his story.
Yeah, so Kevin was a Peace Corps volunteer, a very idealistic young man, kind of like Tom was describing Easton earlier. Came back from Africa, followed his wife, girlfriend at the time, to Cornell, and got an MBA, and found himself working at IBM as the Peace Corps kid. And while he was there, the company announced a plan to try to become a globally integrated enterprise. And he said, what about if IBM sponsored its own internal Peace Corps? If IBM used its resources to help non-governmental organizations or low-income governments with the problems that they have? And initially, he was laughed at, and second time he was laughed at, but he built up support for the idea and ended up helping to create this corporate service corps that IBM sponsored. And it ended up being one of the gems of the company. When they had their 100th anniversary, they said, this is one of the 100 great innovations that IBM has created, and many other companies want to do the same thing. So it's done dozens of projects, thousands of people have been involved in it, and it's been a real success for them, using the resources of the company to do good in the world.
So you said, Jerry, that they said one, twice, that IBM laughed at him. So, you know, we've got to be in a company, and I guess I'm pitching it to both of you. We'll start with you, Jerry. You got to be in a company where they got ears, where they're willing to listen and willing to release their grasp on what they've been doing for many, many decades.
Yeah, it's definitely true. But if you think about the way Tom was describing the next generation, a lot of them really do want to make a difference in the world. If you want to be able to recruit them and keep them and retain their interest, it helps a lot if you're able to say, you can tell your friends you work at a company that has a corporate Peace Corps, or that you're involved in something beyond just sort of corporate social responsibility PR efforts, that the company really does make a difference. So not all companies are going to listen to that message, but my prediction is going forward, if they don't hear that message, if they're not willing to embrace this, they're going to have a very hard time recruiting people under 30.
So both of you said the same thing about these younger people in the workforce. And I want to understand, what is it about this generation that's really different? I mean, generations before them, have been pretty self-absorbed or focused on the dollar or getting wealthy. What changed?
Do you want to take a quick stab at that? And Jerry, I can hand it over to you because I know we both have some opinions on this. But look, a couple of things are changing in a very real sense. They're not just ideological changes. The world is moving faster. We're more connected. Things are happening faster. Uncertainty is increasing. And therefore, we've had to increase our reliance on community. And what these kids are great at is they're great at building communities, whether it be the Arab Spring or whether it be the Occupy movement or whether it be an internal social movement within their organization. They organize instantaneously, and they're accustomed to the speed of that. We call it life hacking. They simply will not take no for an answer. They will hack the system until they figure out a way to find the shortest distance between point A and point B. And they are relentless in doing that because they know they can. They know the tools are there by which they can do that. When you're hyper-connected, you have this enormous influence that is almost as valuable as affluence. You have a form of capital that you can exercise, that you can spend, and that's what these kids are great at. They know how to spend that capital in a way that does change things, disrupts things, but also changes them. And part of being an entrepreneur, and I'll hand it over to Jerry, is being a disruptor, is changing things. You see something that's wrong, and you take the initiative, and you accept part of the risk in doing that as well, I would assume.
So I'd like you, Tom, before we go, what's life hacking?
Life hacking is simply the process of not taking "that's the way we've always done it" as the answer. It is looking at a situation and saying there is something fundamentally flawed about the way we've approached this, and we are therefore going to take the initiative, whether we've been given the blessing or the license, we will take the initiative to change it, and that's what makes it so disruptive. So the Arab Spring was a form of life hacking. It was a way to change political systems through groundswell connectivity of individuals, creating a social movement of any sort, creating a new product that perhaps the organization is somehow not in favor of or is competitive with its existing offerings, but doing it anyway because you know that's what the marketplace needs. That's life hacking.
Sure.
And using the technology, by the way, as a tool of mass disruption, if you will, using the technology to make the change happen.
Well, you know, my generation did that, but it was
absolutely.
With bell bottoms taking to the streets.
Well, you had brightly colored Volkswagen vans to change the world. These kids have the internet. A bit of a difference there in terms of the impact you can have with one or the other.
Yeah, but we had better colors. Jerry, let me turn to you about your ability to explain what's happening with this generation and why are they more socially active, socially invested than previous generations?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think the thing to know about the Gen Z, like I also have a couple of kids in that generation, they've grown up believing that all the world's information is always available at a moment's notice, at a touch. So if I ask my kids, there are no bar bets anymore. How many left-handed presidents have there been? What is Boyle's Law? What's the formula for kurtosis? These guys assume that all that knowledge is universally available at all times. And that can be, that's an incredible experience. That's not the world that we grew up in. So I'm a college professor. What do I have to tell kids who can look up the correct answer at any moment? It really changes what education is going to look at. I'd say the reason that it's different, so bell-bottoms and Volkswagen buses, well, maybe not Volkswagen, bell-bottoms.
You are a social activist, aren't you?
deep down I am. But think about the March on Washington in 1963, where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, and the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square in particular. So both had similar numbers of people, 300,000 to 400,000 people showed up at one spot. March on Washington, there were hundreds of marshals, thousands of people involved in organizing. They had to use the post office to send letters to people, organize carpools. They had to find host families. All of that was done through the mail and by phone, and it took about 8 months to organize that march. Tahrir Square, it took 10 days. It was a website called We Are All Khaled Said on Facebook that was sort of a meeting place for people. They said, how many people would show up if we did a march on this day? More than 50,000 signed up. And so they said, all right, we're going to do it. That's the difference, is that the transaction costs, the costs of organizing on a very large scale, are much lower now. So if you have a powerful idea, it can grow much more rapidly than it did even 10 or 15 years ago. So it's possible for things to go viral or to become to take place on a grand scale in a way that wasn't true before, with very low cost. Activists don't need to pay it. The flip side of that is bad ideas can spread really quickly as well. And so our traditional ideas about hierarchies, you know, look at pity the Republican Party trying to have the grown-ups be in charge these days, because we are not limited to the discourse dictated by elites, for better or worse.
I want to understand something that you've said earlier, and that's about the speed with which we can create social movements. Is it something about that changes things for these Gen Zs, that the fact that they can create movements, does that change their mentality about the larger world and their responsibility?
Yeah, I'd say there's two parts to that. One is that it's a lot easier to become aware of grievances or things to be concerned about. So think about how smartphones, the fact that everyone has a video recorder with them, think how that's changed our perceptions of policing in America in the last year and a half. Mm. So it's much easier to get information out at a grassroots level and make people aware of that. And the flip side is that if you have an idea that becomes that has some power to it, that has some cachet or some ability to catch on, it's much quicker and cheaper for it to become widely shared. So social movements can emerge much more rapidly than they did before.
So I want to know more about intrapreneurship because, you know, in today's economy, people are working in jobs that don't line up with their, you know, their deepest values, environmentalists working at an energy companies, for example. And, you know, there's 100 examples of that. So how do people align their interests and values with those of their company?
Yeah. So one is before they even get hired at the company, they want to see that it stands for something that they're not going to find embarrassing. they don't want to recruit at a company if they have valuable skills. They don't want to go to work for a place that they're not going to feel good about. And so making, and you can't be hypocritical. If you say we're all about the environment, someone's going to uncover if that's not true, and it'll become public. So it's,
wait a minute. With my opening words were in today's economy, you know, how many young people have the luxury of doing that? These are desperate times for kids coming out of high school and college.
That's certainly true. So I teach at a business school, and our students are in very high demand. So it is a message
right
that makes sense to people that know Python coding or know how to do discounted cash flow analysis. So it's certainly for those with skills in demand. That's a fair point.
Yeah. So, you know, somebody coming out of college or high school, you know, they're stuck in these jobs. And you know, how do they kind of reconcile what their deepest beliefs are working in a job that, you know, don't fit their deepest beliefs? Is this where intrapreneurship comes in?
Yeah, we've certainly had a lot of students, and I know a lot of people that found themselves working at oil companies, electric generation companies that still had environmental beliefs, and they were able to work within the system. I think for the same reason why we see the Arab Spring these days, we're seeing similar things taking place in companies, because you don't just have to follow those rules. If there are others that think the way you do at the company, it's now easier to find them and advocate.
Well, we've got to take a short break, and when we do, I want to break that down a bit, Jerry, about intrapreneurship, and you've got a list of steps to take, too. We're talking with Tom Kalopoulos. He wrote The Gen Z Effect with Dan Keljan, and he's founder of the Delphi Group. Jerry Davis is a professor of management at Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. His book is Changing Your Company, From the Inside Out, a Guide for Social Intrapreneurs. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us about your company. Would you like to change it from the inside out? Does it fit your deepest values? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Wood Services proudly supports WHYY. Since 1913, Wood Services has helped change the lives of children and adults with special needs, like Maddie. Arriving at the age of 15, Maddie had access to the meaningful care and life-altering supports that Woods provides to individuals on the autism spectrum who deal with frequent angry outbursts. 2 years later, Maddie is bringing joy to her family and those around her. Woods helps people with special needs achieve success. Learn more at woods.org. Wood Services. Exceptional people. Fulfilling lives.
Bryn Mawr Trust. Providing solutions for personal banking, business banking, wealth management, and insurance since 1889. Bryn Mawr Trust. The proven choice. Proud supporter of WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're joined by Tom Koulopoulos and Jerry Davis about these generational changes in the workplace and kind of bridging, that's not even the right word, bridging the digital divide. It's kind of holding hands and going through it together. I want you, Jerry, to tell us what to do if we want to change our companies. What's the first step?
We have a four-step program, which describes things in terms of the when, why, who, and how. And so when is figuring out what's the opportunity structure look like? When does a social movement take off? When does an innovation take off? A lot of people don't actually know anything about their company's strategy. So there are ways that you can find that out, but you want to have an innovation that can plausibly be linked to the company's strategy or priorities. So corporate Peace Corps, why is that a good idea for IBM? Because they're trying to become a globally integrated enterprise, and this helps them address that.
So I want to know, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts, Tom, also about how companies change and how you, we, Gen Z, can help companies change.
Look, one of the fundamental, the cornerstone of all organizational change is the attitude and the culture that is created by leadership to give people license to disrupt and to sometimes fail. And I say this with not tongue-in-cheek. I mean this quite literally. There are organizations that are very specific about providing their people with the mandate to experiment, to take risks. I mean, folks like companies like Google are exceptional at this, but it doesn't just apply to high-tech companies. If you give people license to fail, then they'll take the risk. They'll try to do something which is disruptive, which might have the potential of failure, but they'll do it for the right reasons. And I think this is a very tactical thing that most organizations ignore. They create a fear of failure. They create a tremendous sense of if you fail, it will be punitive. You know, there's no latitude by which to fail. I had one CEO I worked with for quite some time who did a wonderful full-day session with his executive team on innovation. At the end of the day, after talking a full day about innovation, he said, "Now, don't forget, in our company, we have unlimited downside and very limited upside." That kills innovation. That's the kiss of death at that point. So if you create a culture where you foster this notion that experimentation is not only reasonable, but we expect that we will fail at it periodically, and we're willing to take that. That's what 3M does. That's how 3M has succeeded. Then you create a culture which does foster intrapreneurship, where people want to be internal intrapreneurs, where they want to accept that risk, because no form of entrepreneurship, wherever it is, inside or outside the organization, exists without risk. It's not that the risk is absent, it's that the risk is accepted and that the effort is made in spite of it. So I think leadership has a tremendous responsibility to create that license to experiment and that license to fail and to be articulate about it, not just to be implicit, but to be explicit about what that means.
Okay, so let me turn to you here, Jerry, and let's say I work at that company. I am not say I'm middle management here, how can I mobilize people to change the culture on the inside? How can I find a way to educate that CEO?
I think that what Tom was describing is exactly right, that that you need to have a culture that fosters that. But even in cultures that don't look like they're going to foster that change, there are things that signal that they might be open to that. And the thing is that innovations are kind of like tofu, picking up the flavors around them. You can, if you feel strongly about your innovation and you want to press it, you're likely to be able to find allies, and you're likely to be able to find a way that connects with the culture of that organization. So SC Johnson is a famous consumer products company. They're still very much a family company. And so they respond to appeals about family and legacy. IBM really wants to be a global company. They're going to respond to appeals about globalization and leadership development. So you need to know the culture well enough to know what kind of innovation and what kind of pitch for that innovation are going to work within that particular context. And I'd say it's not hopeless anywhere. One of the examples we give in the book is the spread of domestic partner benefits for LGBT employees. And in the early 1990s, that was considered just beyond the pale, just a crazy idea. Lotus did it. By 2 years ago, Walmart had domestic partner benefits for LGBT employees. It sort of spread in a wave from company to company. And that's a pretty bold thing to advocate for, because in 29 states in the U.S., you can still be fired for being gay. So coming out as an advocate for something like this is not without a career risk, but a lot of bold innovators did that. And it ended up changing the conversation in corporate America about what's appropriate. If Walmart does it, it can't be on the fringe anymore.
Mm. Is it easier today to be that bold, to be that aggressive? Does it make it easier, this new world?
Well, so yes and no. With at-will employment, it's a lot easier to fire people that are making trouble. And a lot more employees are likely to be, as you mentioned, they're likely to be temps, part-time workers that don't really have a lot of power. On the other side, I think that the corporate America is much more aware that they need to be attentive to these things. You can't really avoid values questions the way that you used to.
Mm. I want to turn to you, Tom. You know, last week's show was about raising compassionate kids in an age of entitlement. And I'm wondering, these younger generations entering the workforce, I'm wondering how they experience themselves, what they owe the world, what they're entitled to, what they have to give.
That's a wonderful question, because there's so many different dimensions to it. You know, let me take a stab at it, Dan, because you asked it, and I think it deserves to some degree that we address it here, although we could take so much more time to talk right about this. But let me boil it down to what I think is its essence. You talked about compassionate children and how they experience themselves, how these kids experience themselves today in this hyper-connected world, in this workforce that is so volatile and so uncertain. Let me change that question just a little bit, because in my sense, compassion comes from an underlying tolerance, that we accept differences even though we don't necessarily understand them. And yet we try to be empathetic to those differences. We try somehow to rationalize our own values, beliefs, attitudes around very different set of attitudes. And culturally, if you think of it on a global basis, this is a struggle. It has been a struggle for quite some time. The internet changes that. Hyperconnectivity changes that. Gen Z, the millennials were the beta test for Gen Z. Gen Z has grown up with this technology from the womb. They've come out into the world connected. They know nothing other than to be connected. And as a result, that connectivity has created a tolerance in them that didn't exist ever before in the entire existence of humanity. And that tolerance, I think, leads to compassion and a sense of self-awareness and an understanding of self relative to the rest of the world that creates a much more likely situation within which people will collaborate across those otherwise very hard cultural divides, generational divides. And I see this. I see this, I mentioned earlier, in the way kids game, but I also see it in the way we're beginning to work. And it will take time for Gen Z to make its way through the workforce to bring these behaviors with it. But that is exactly what's going to happen, is that they will work the way they game. They will bring this tolerance and this sense of empathy and awareness of self to the workforce, because that is all they've known. That's what they've grown up with.
I wonder if there's a component of that, you know, the sense of what they owe. I wonder about, you know, the suffering in the world, if they feel a kind of personal involvement or personal responsibility to do something about it.
Well, the internet does two things to us, right? It exposes us to more of that suffering, and at the same time, it makes us a bit more numb to that suffering because we see it so frequently.
Right.
So I wish I could give you a black and white answer to a question that has a lot of shades of gray, frankly. What I see in the children that I work with, what I see in my graduate and my undergraduate students at Boston University, is that there is a melding, a cultural melding that is occurring that is much more pronounced than anything I had experienced. And that part of what that melding does is it causes them to ask the question, how do we make the world better? And that sounds horribly idealistic, but they want to do it in a very tactical sense. They want to do what Easton is doing. They want to take an idea and provide it to the masses. They want to provide sanitary water. They want to provide health care. They want to do things that are actionable. They don't just want to think about it. They don't just want to hold a flag on a street corner that says peace. They want to do something to create that peace. And that, to me, is a fundamental difference in how these kids operate, because they believe that they can have that impact, that the tools and technologies they have allow them to create community instantaneously, as Jerry was saying, and as a result to have that impact. And that's a very different attitude to bring to the world than the attitude that certainly my generation brought to the world.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've got Peter on the line. Hey, Peter.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a psychology student at a university in the area, and I thought your conversation today is very, very interesting from a whole bunch of perspectives. But I'm particularly interested. I was at a conference recently which was about distraction in the modern age, and they were suggesting that our current society is more distracted than any other point in history. And there seems to be a similar tenor around this conversation, that in some way more things have changed now than have in the past. And I think maybe that's a little bit dangerous to say. As a psych student, I've come to understand that all change is perceived as loss. And there's this idea that just because technology is now a bigger part of our lives and is more significant for people as they grow up, that what's changed in the way kids grow up and in the way we approach the world is somehow a loss, even though it's different, or just because it's different from the way we have in the past. So I wonder if your guest could speak to that.
That's interesting. Let me turn that over to you, Tom.
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful observation. I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, we do always look at technology as subtractive. It's taking away from us our ability to socialize. It's creating more antiseptic kids. It's, you know, they're online. They're not face-to-face. They look at their palms and their iPhones, not at each other's eyeballs. That is a very subtractive way to look at the way we're moving forward. And frankly, I had ancestors, being of Greek descent, I think I did anyway, somewhere in my DNA, there are strands of their being at the foot of the Acropolis that were having this conversation about storytelling and writing. The great philosophers did not want to reduce, some of them did not want to reduce, thank God for Plato, didn't want to reduce storytelling to written form. They felt it would be subtractive to the human experience. How absurd. It's not subtractive. We still tell stories orally. We also write and we have e-books. All of this is additive. It makes a richer experience. It does distract. But I'm not sure distraction is always a bad thing. I think distraction sometimes leads us to see things that we wouldn't otherwise see in the bubble that we create around ourselves. These kids know that. They're accustomed to it. They're building behaviors to deal with that distraction. But the important thing is that it's not subtractive. It creates a richer experience. And we have an example in the book about a young child with Tourette's syndrome who he had a horrible case of Tourette's. He couldn't work. He couldn't go to school. But when he put on a headset and gamed, not the keyboard, just the headset, the Tourette's went away. here's a child who can now be part of the workforce. That's an additive experience. He will be part of the workforce, whereas he could not have been without that technology. So it's not subtractive. I try to constantly bring that up with people. I'm so glad the caller raised that point. I think it's a critical one for us to keep in mind as we move forward.
Yeah, Peter, thanks so much for your call. But I want to turn to you. He used the word distracted. And, you know, I'm a clinician, and I see ADD, and I see for myself. I mean, my attention span these days is that of a hyperactive gnat on steroids. I mean, it's not good here.
It isn't. And as I said earlier, we're going through a behavioral shift here. Not all these behaviors are good behaviors. I personally believe that you have to architect time when that distraction does not exist. I did it with my kids. I would take them to places where they simply didn't have the option to be connected. And they benefited from that. I think we need that as human beings. We need that detachment, and we have to now consciously architect it into our lives. It will not just happen. It won't happen anecdotally or coincidentally. You have to do it very purposefully. And that's a behavior that we haven't quite figured out yet. Most of us are still not comfortable leaving our iPhone or our Android, whatever it happens to be, behind without a panic attack closely following thereafter.
Yeah, Jerry, I think part of that is because I think most of us live with delusions of importance. You know, something terrible will happen if I don't respond to that instantly, or I'm that important.
One thing that I'd want to add here is that the technology allows people to be involved in a portfolio of activities all at the same time. And so one of the trade-offs here is we used to have institutions that you could expect to last for a long time, like Eastman Kodak. Now we have short-term businesses that are pop-ups and might have temporary employees. Generation Z is a lot more used to having three jobs. One is a part-time dog walker, one driving for Uber, and one working on their sort of nonprofit foundation. And people are used to doing a lot more things at once. Any one of them might not be so durable, but people participate in, you know, my daughter is on five conversations at once in text. That would have been inconceivable before.
Well, I think that's an important note to end on. Unfortunately, we're out of town. Tom Koulopoulos and Jerry Davis, I want to thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes, thanks, Dan.
Tom Koulopoulos wrote The Gen Z Effect. Jerry Davis wrote Changing Your Company from the Inside Out. If you haven't pledged already, please consider doing so now. It's at 1-888-345-9499. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Help us get to 1,000 followers. And email us at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our EP. Trin Thatch is our intern. Larry Roebling produces the show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.